Just a quick reminder, this podcast may contain general advice, but it doesn't take into account your personal circumstances, needs, or objectives. The scenarios and stocks mentioned in this podcast are for illustrative purposes only and do not constitute a recommendation to buy, hold, or sell any financial products. Read the relevant PDS, assess whether that information is appropriate for you, and consider speaking to a financial advisor before making investment decisions. Past performance is no indicator of future performance.
Hello and welcome to Stocks Neat. I'm Steve Johnson, Chief Investment Officer here at Forager Funds, and this is a podcast where we talk stocks and sometimes sip a few whiskies. I'm joined today by Harvey Magotti. Harvey, you and I have just got back from a little trip around the world. You were away a bit longer than me. We're not having a whiskey today, a bit much on the plate, but did you try anything interesting on your travels?
I did. You know, we were in Japan for a few days and I got a chance to obviously, you know, drink some of the classics, Yamazaki, etc. But I think the one that stood out as really good value is the Suntory AO. And it's a bit of a weirdo. It's a blend of whiskeys from five different countries made by Suntory. Really drinkable, especially if you do it neat. I think if you put ice in it, it kind of ruins it. You'd think it's a scotch for a second, I would reckon. But, you know, there's a kick of bourbon and rye spice in there. So I really enjoyed it. At the airport, you could buy it for $48. You know, when I was coming back from Japan, and then I looked at the prices here, and it's the minimum one I could find is 178. So not so easy to grab here in Oz. If you do find it, I still recommend it. I think it's a great little kind of interesting idea that Suntory is doing. But ideally, if you ever go to Japan, you pick one up off the shelf there, or even just in the regular stores in town. I mean, it was still a third of the price. So yeah, so that was pretty fun.
Yeah, we found quite a bit of cheap stuff in Japan, but our first stop was the US and anything but cheap with the exchange rate where it is at the moment. Found it extraordinarily expensive. Personally, in Chicago, where we went out and had a steak at the end of the week before we flew out at a admittedly very nice steak restaurant, but it's $80 each for just the steak piece and a glass of wine each, and we racked up $300 pretty quickly on the bill. So $500 for a steak and glass of wine for the two of us was a pretty expensive night out. And that was a bit of a shock to the system for me over there. I think we just forget here in Australia how much the currency depreciation has been a fairly painless adjustment for the Australian economy in terms of when you think about house prices and asset prices, and you now convert it to US dollars at 63 versus parity, where it was sort of 5 or 6 years ago. Most of the prices haven't changed that much. So yeah, very expensive place.
Well, they've actually, you know, kind of, I've been going there, what, 2 to 3 times a year for the past 5 years. And you see it sequential kind of drift higher, whether it's hotels, which are now 2 to 3 times for the same hotel and at the same time period as they were prior to COVID. But even in that post-COVID period when, you know, things opened up again, it hurts a bit, you know. I have to say other things as well. You know, I think beef prices have at least doubled, and that's in the Costco's of the world, right? So not even your kind of fancy steak restaurant. But, you know, having said that, I still remember that steak, so I would do it again gladly.
It was quite delicious. So what was your general impression? I mean, inflation has been high, has been coming down much quicker than it has here in Australia on the official figures. We met with probably 40 companies between the two of us across a 2-day conference put on by Baird, all industrials companies. That's what the conference is. And it was a really, really enjoyable conference. Maybe kick things off with, I guess, the general state of the economy from the companies that you met with over there.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's still chugging along very firmly. The macro is still weighing on companies, and it is weighing on certain end markets given, you know, higher rates. It's obvious, but consumer is definitely, you know, feeling the pressure more and more, and some of those savings built up during the COVID stimulus times, they are waning. You're starting to see that in retail figures. China's been soggy for some industrials exporting out abroad, plus a strong dollar that is hurting them. But the domestic U.S. economy, especially on the industrial front, is doing quite well. And, you know, there's many themes that are playing out there, which we'll discuss in due course here. But I think companies are generally positive, you know, especially about the kind of 3 to 4 year outlook. There's a few macro factors and government stimulus factors converging.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible if we were at a consumer conference, it would have been a very different vibe about the place. And yeah, a lot of US companies are quite dependent or certainly for their growth on that Chinese consumer, which has been very, very weak. But in that industrial space, there's some, I think, very helpful tailwinds going on in the economy. And a lot of companies saying to us, it's been helpful, but it's not even yet
hasn't even
full
started. That's 100% correct. I mean, look, so what we saw is the building product distributors, you know, had a pretty optimistic tone. Most were predicting decent growth in single family housing starts next year. Obviously, coming off a pretty low base in 23, but they've navigated it extremely well, I would say. Most of the high quality ones, at least. Repair and remodeling activity is holding on pretty steadily. You know, some people are trapped in their houses given they've locked in really good 30-year mortgages. So what do you do when you have some excess cash? You don't go out and upgrade a house. You build a new kitchen just like you're doing now, Steve. So I think we're seeing that happening, and it was categorized as a consistent and resilient pocket there. And, you know, we have some stocks that are exposed to that theme, so that felt good. You know, we did hear about various other pockets of strength out there. HVAC, you know, so air conditioning and so forth, that, you know, they continue to see double-digit price increases there, the companies. And distributors such as Ferguson, which is one of our largest positions, continue to see tailwinds there, both from pricing, but there's also a few regulatory factors coming into play. So there's a refrigerant transition happening in 2025, and, you know, new models have come out that are much more energy efficient. So I think people are looking to save on their energy costs and using this as an opportunity to upgrade their, you know, home air cons or commercial air conditioning systems and so forth.
Yeah, it was really common across almost every company I met with talking about acquisition opportunities in this space. We live in an economy here in Australia that is dominated by oligopolistic industries where there's only two or three giant players. And that process of consolidation almost feels like it's accelerating, if anything, in the US. There are some industries where it is already towards the end of its cycle, but lots of companies that we met with where they're the largest player in their sector, but they're 13 and 14% market shares and gobbling up all of these smaller operators. It was a really consistent story across a fairly wide range of companies.
Yeah, and it's what's allowed a lot of these ultra-high quality businesses like Watsco, like Ferguson, like Pool Corp, that are kind of market leaders in their areas, but as you mentioned, still a small portion of the market, in a very fragmented mom-and-pop market, to continue growing for many, many decades, you know? I mean, a name like Watsco has had 40 years of consistent growth, both organically and through acquisitions. And I don't think we're anywhere near done in many of those cases. So it's an exciting kind of end market to have some exposure to.
The advantage of just being a giant self-contained economy in that respect, yeah. Right? I think most of that happens here in Australia as well, but normally it's private equity rolls up. Pretty quickly, you can roll up a sector in the whole Australian economy, and then you bring it to the stock market, and it's already done.
Yeah.
Mature. You know, we've had exceptions. I think the JB Hi-Fis of the world that have done very well in certain spaces. Reece here, and we spoke to a couple of competitors of Reece over in my meetings in the US. They're doing pretty well over there in the US as well. So there are examples of companies that have done it well here, but just the number and the runway in the US is quite striking, and I felt like it was pretty consistently playing into more resilient margins in this more difficult economic environment than I would have expected historically. I think as you get more consolidation in these sectors, you get more rational behavior both during downturns and on the other side, and we heard a lot about that as well.
No, exactly. It's not exactly great for the customers or perhaps the consumers, but it's a beautiful setup for many of these businesses, and I think, you know, generally the profit margin commentary across the board was pretty positive. You know, most companies were talking about achieving price cost neutrality. They're seeing benefits from, you know, positive pricing, but also softening freight expenses, which have been a big headwind over recent years, as you can imagine, particularly in that 2020-21 period. I also heard from a number of companies how they're seeing lower labor turnover and less cost inflation from labor, which is obviously has been another pain point, you know, not just getting people, but also, you know, the amount you're having to pay them and wage hikes. So that's also very positive for some of these larger businesses.
So I guess across the spectrum of companies you looked at, there's a lot of talk as well on government policy. It's been a huge, I guess, change with the Biden administration around what sectors are getting the money and how much money they're getting. Who are the big winners out of some of that regulatory and government stimulus backdrop?
Well, there was definitely a great deal of discussion on these mega projects and, you know, secular drivers that are happening over the next few years. So you've got the U.S. infrastructure stimulus, the Semiconductor Chips Act, and the continued reshoring happening in the U.S. You know, I think all these companies realize they can't rely on a supply chain that's sitting in China and you know, all these other places, and they do want to bring more manufacturing capacity in-house. So they should provide, you know, really strong tailwinds for many types of U.S. industrials in the coming years. I heard from a few that the real acceleration is only going to start in 2025. You know, you're just seeing one categorized it as not even halfway through the first inning as of today. So
surprise anyone to hear that the actual mechanisms, the policy has been passed, but the mechanisms of actually getting the money into the companies,
that's been very slow and frustrating. There's a labor shortage on the construction side and, you know, a lack of equipment in certain areas. So it's not going to be a straight line. It's not going to just zip upwards. But I think cumulatively, when you look back in 2026 or 2027, when you look back and stack it all up, you would have seen the kind of boost that a lot of these companies have gotten.
Are there any companies or, I guess, sectors that you would say are bigger winners and beneficiaries out of that than others?
Yeah, the ones that are expected to benefit the most are certainly the infrastructure, industrial infrastructure businesses, or, you know, things exposed to road construction, bridges, and so forth. So cement players, aggregate names, equipment rental companies.
I was trying to have a sleep on it. We did a day of company tours, and I was fresh off the plane after a long flight, and I was trying to have a sleep. And about every 10 seconds on the bus, we hit a massive, I don't even know pothole. That it was a pothole. It was more like the road was actually collapsing.
The state
every
of infrastructure
20 or 30
there is
and whacked my head against
awful.
The side of the bus, and it was impossible to go to sleep.
It's tough driving there sometimes. You know, we've popped a few tires on our trips, and, you know, it's not because there's a nail on the road, it's because there's all this gravel and there's potholes all around. So it needs to be fixed.
Giant,
it really does.
Giant F-100s.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, and others that are supposed to benefit are, you know, semiconductor equipment names, obviously. So pick and shovel suppliers to this kind of chips arms race that's happening globally. Automation companies, so labor savings and so forth. Anything to do with Internet of Things providers. And, you know, there's a decent stimulus going on in terms of broadband expansion to rural areas in the U.S. and companies exposed to that also obviously winners. These were just some sectors kind of off the top of my head. There's many others, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's fascinating that the federal government deficit over there is 7.5% of GDP at the moment. And there's all of this expenditure still to come. And neither side, really, the Republicans nor the Democrats, are talking about doing anything about that in terms of this next election cycle. So I think it's worth worrying about the midterm consequences of that. I think it will be inflationary, and that this inflation problem is not going to go away as quickly as markets are currently anticipating. But certainly this next 4 or 5 years, there are no signs of anyone cutting back on some of this stuff.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a sec. Are you a long-term investor with a passion for unloved bargains? So are we. Forager Funds is a contemporary value fund manager with a proven track record for finding opportunities in unlikely places. Through our Australian and international shares funds, investors have access to small and mid-sized investments not accessible to many fund managers, in businesses that many investors likely haven't heard of. We have serious skin in the game too, meaning we invest right alongside our investors. For more information about our investments, visit foragerfunds.com. And if you like what you're hearing and what we're drinking, please like, subscribe, and pass it on. Thanks for tuning in. Now, back to the chat.
I mean, at least we're seeing some sort of softening in things such as food prices in the U.S. You know, if you look at the chart, it looks like a parabola going up, and, you know, they were going up 10-20% year on year, and now they're stabilized at a low single-digit rate. So there's some positive signs out there, at least from people that don't want inflation.
Yeah, you're definitely going to get lower headline inflation numbers over the next 12 months while some of those temporary things flatten,
roll off,
reverse in some examples. You're going to have negative contributions. That doesn't mean in 3 or 4 years' time that some of the more permanent issues aren't coming back to the fore. We left Chicago and went directly to Tokyo. We've been wanting to get up there for some time. There's some really interesting things happening in the Japanese economy. It was also, how many thousands of dollars was it cheaper to fly home via Japan and straight back to Australia?
4,000 or 5,000. It's crazy.
It was a crazy price differential. So the ticket that was found for us was much more attractively priced that way. And as I said, we've been meaning to get up there for some time, and some really interesting changes. It's not new, but it feels like it's gathering some momentum up there in Japan.
Yeah, no, there's a bunch of real positive initiatives taking place. Both the government and the Japan Stock Exchange Group, they're pushing for companies to boost returns to shareholders, improve investor communication, and they're trying to make Japan a much more interesting place for foreign investment. You know, the Japan Stock Exchange Group actually came by here, so we met them in our office 2 months ago now, and it was funny because they weren't talking about, you know, their stock themselves, like you should invest in the Japan Stock Exchange Group. They were talking about why they are creating Japan, or changing Japan, to be a more interesting place to invest. They're going to be naming and shaming companies that aren't hitting those metrics. They're going to be naming and shaming companies that are sitting on a pile of cash doing nothing with it, and thereby lowering returns for shareholders and not optimizing, I think, you know, potential share price appreciation. And that is a big change, I think, from, you know, the Japan of 5-10 years ago.
What are the key things they want companies to do?
So those are some of them. They want people to start deploying some of the money that's been sitting on the balance sheet for, you know, many, many, many years, improving investor communications, being more transparent, setting longer term targets at their AGMs or annual meetings, and communicating them clearly. You know, they're separating the Tokyo Stock Exchange into prime and standard. So only the companies that kind of hit some of those metrics and those boxes, tick those boxes, get onto the prime exchange. They're also going to be launching active ETFs. So we have them in the US. You know, if you want to invest in a semiconductor ETF, you have that. It's kind of a more actively managed number of companies, and you don't have to worry so much about picking them yourself then. If you want to invest in quality, there's a quality active ETF and so forth. And Japan hasn't had that. They've had ETFs, you know, that are basically just tracking the index, and they're starting to do that themselves. So that could be really interesting, because you might want to be investing in a certain thematic in Japan, but not necessarily in the overall index. And I think that just opens up the gateway. It's the first year in many where we've seen some real positive inflows into that market as well. It's been one of the best performers, I think, this year.
Yeah, it has actually been the best performing major index in the world. The topics, the main Japanese sort of domestic index up there, and outperformed even S&P 500, which has been on a bit of a tear over the course of this year. So certainly investors are getting enthusiastic about it, more and more international investors getting on the bandwagon. Are you actually seeing companies change? I mean, I was up in Tokyo 10 years ago for an investor conference. The government has been pushing for change for a long time. There's been a lot of talk about the potential upside if companies can unwind some of these cross shareholdings and return excess cash to shareholders, and not a lot happened for the subsequent 10 years. Are you actually seeing companies change their behavior?
Well, we've seen some really good case studies with the likes of Sony that embarked on this journey back in 2014, 15, or whatever it was. We bought it back in 2019, kind of on the back of that. And, you know, they've clearly had excess returns over and above the market since that period. Investor communication has improved. They've been doing some very rational stuff with the portfolio. And there are examples where it's been happening. You're slowly starting to see that trickle down to the smaller, or the more mid-cap size companies, and not the large international behemoths. And I think that's really, really positive. So first, early innings, I would say.
Yeah.
And I'm certain that many will not just refuse to budge. But if you can find the ones that do, we've clearly seen some really good examples when they do it. It makes for a great little investment.
Yes, is a very common answer up in Japan, whether they mean yes or whether they mean yes or not. But I think you're absolutely right. I think directionally it is very, very real. Whether it happens as quickly as some investors are now anticipating, I think there's probably potential for some disappointment, as that process unwinds, but directionally it's headed in the right way. And I also just think the economy, a lot of the companies up there that have really suffered from China's rise from a global trade perspective are pretty well placed, because it's still dramatically cheaper to manufacture something in Japan than it is in the US. And with a lot of companies turning away from China, or seeing China as a source of risk in terms of their supply chain, Japan's really coming back to the fore. And I think some of the greener incentives around the world also play into a lot of these Japanese companies' hands, because they've been at the forefront of some of those technologies for a long time. One that really interested me in some of our company visits is some of the grid infrastructure. It's a really boring topic, but if we are going to have a greener electricity grid, there's an enormous amount of focus on solar panels and wind farms and different types of technology to generate the electricity. But we also need dramatic change to the grid to deliver that electricity to people's houses, and there's trillions of dollars around the world that needs to be invested in that, and a fairly small number of companies that can actually deliver that infrastructure. So there's a lot of optimism, I think, about the governance changes, and a fair bit of optimism as well about the position that Japan as a country has in the global trade. For the first time in a really long time, I think they've been on the losing end of China's rise, and now companies seeing a fair bit of real inbound demand for their products because of exchange rate and because of a change in perception. I was surprised. I know the index is up, but a lot of the small and mid-cap companies that we talked to people about up there have seen dramatic share price increases over the past 12 months. In that context, was there anything interesting that you came across from an actual investment perspective on our trip?
Yeah, no, we've been doing some work on the Japan IT space and domestic IT spending for a few months now. And I think that our meetings there just confirmed that there's potentially a multi-year story. So, I mean, what's happening? The government is starting to enforce digital invoicing and receipts. And while that sounds like something obvious that you do, many Japanese companies, especially anything up outside of those large multinationals and, you know, they're really kind of higher quality companies, they still invoice using paper and stamps. And they're really far behind, I think, the West in terms of digitization. So there's
which is bizarre because you see so much technology in that country.
I know,
it's
really weird. It's a two-edged sword almost. So there's a real drive towards investing into software and cloud that's starting up there. The Japanese SMEs, they're at least a decade behind the West when it comes to this kind of digitization process and getting used to it. And what really kick-started was COVID, when you couldn't really go to the office. You had to start, you know, using a PC to communicate and doing stuff digitally. And that really drove this change from, I guess, a sleeping giant pool of companies there. And the government also, I think, realized that we need to take dramatic steps to move this forward. So, you know, there's also a significant labor shortage in the country already. It's set to get much worse given demographics. So investment into digital productivity tools, software IT, you know, they're really important steps to try to mitigate some of the pressures that will come from these labor shortages that are already there, but are going to be getting worse.
We checked into our hotel when we arrived without talking to a person at all. They've got these little kiosks where you type your details in, you scan your passport or whatever ID document you've got, and it prints you out a room key and tells you where you need to go.
And if you wanted, you could step to the left and speak, you know, get the check-in staff. There were three of them. It's not like there weren't, but it was just so efficient. You know, I love just not having to deal with anything.
And you didn't have to tip it.
That's more of the US when they'll ask for a tip to check you in. So we also found some interesting ideas in the video game space and within the semiconductor supply chain, which we're kicking the tires on now already as a team. So should be exciting. And I genuinely think it's going to be an interesting place if you pick your bets right and you pick your sectors right, a place where you can really earn excess returns over the coming years.
I know you don't want to talk too much about names, but we have to tell the funny story about Toto.
Okay. I'll let you do that one.
I don't know how many listeners are familiar with familiar with the Toto toilet, but it's an experience that any visitor to Japan will never forget from the West. I'm actually a huge, huge, huge fan. I think when you talk about cultural differences, a lot of people from Japan must come here and say, I can't believe the way you go to the toilet. It's very, very, very backwards. We think they're backwards with their invoicing systems. They must think we're quite backwards with the way we go to the toilet. But anyway, there's a listed company that makes these very, very technological toilets that wash your bum and keep you warm and do all sorts of things while you're sitting on the toilet. And they retail for $10,000 here in Australia. So it's very expensive, but a very mature but profitable business listed in Japan. And we went to a lunch where the guy who covers Toto was very adamant that we should not be thinking of it as a toilet business.
That's right. It's now apparently semiconductor business because half of their earnings and all of their growth over the next few years is going to come from the semiconductor business that they've bought God knows when. We just thought that was really funny. Who would expect it? You know, I make toilets and also make semiconductor components or parts of the supply, you know, feed into the supply chain. It was bizarre.
Only in Japan. What's your gut feel about it? Is the opportunity in a broad sense gone for investors given the price movements? Do you think this is just the early days of a longer period of improvement in terms of returns from that market over there?
I feel it's early days. I mean, maybe, you know, the run this year, maybe there's a bit of a pause coming. Yes, but you can clearly see attractive valuations, some really high quality businesses. And if you really get that shift and they start deploying, you know, some of these companies are sitting at 20, 30% of their market cap in cash. They do nothing with it. It's not even invested. It's just sitting in the bank account at 0% interest. So if that starts happening, it could be really exciting. And, you know, there are definitely sectors there that already are exciting. We own Sony for that reason. We're looking at various IT, Japanese IT domestic service names for that reason. There's a multi-year growth story there. And if you can merge that with overall excitement about the index and as a country to invest in itself, I think that could be can be potentially quite powerful. But it certainly won't be a straight line upwards, I don't think, you know.
No, some disappointments might be helpful in terms of us getting more of the portfolio invested up there over time.
Yeah.
One other really interesting thing for me when I got home, just thinking about the whole experience, I haven't done a lot of, you've done a lot more travel than me, but I haven't done a huge amount of travel over the past few years, but I was flicking through The Economist on the way home and you get to the second last page and they've got the OECD 20 countries at the back and just it's a page full of data. And I was just reflecting on the stimulus going on in the US and the impact on government fiscal situation over there running a 7.5% deficit. And you go down the column that is fiscal deficit and it is most developed countries in the world running massive fiscal deficits, fours, fives, seven and a halves, eights and nines, Brazil, most of Europe. It's happening all over the place. You've got Norway and Australia sitting there running fiscal surpluses. Not surprisingly, Norway's got the oil. We've got the iron ore. It may just be good luck. It's certainly not good management given what we've seen from the politicians over the past few years. But with the currency where it's at, I think India showing really, really strong signs of being another China in terms of demand for these resources.
Yep.
If I was sitting outside and had all my money invested in US dollars, I'd be looking at this part of the world and thinking of it as a pretty sensible place to be invested over the next 10 years with that sort of setup relative to how a lot of other countries are positioned. Alrighty, Harvey, we will wrap it up with that. It's been a really interesting chat. It was great fun traveling with you and a nice reflection on some of the opportunities that we've seen out there.
Thank you. See you all.
Hope you enjoyed listening in. As always, any questions or comments you have, fire them through to admin@foragerfunds.com or feel free to be old school and give us a call. Thanks for listening in.
Thank you.